We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Wednesday, May 8th, and it is a beautiful day in the free state of Florida. It is a gorgeous day, as Ben Sasse, or glorious, I think that was his term, was glorious. Everything is just glorious. When he was on CNN with Jake Tapper, I was still laughing about that because everything is just glorious in the free state of Florida, but it really is. My two little dogs woke up very early this morning. They've been getting up with the sun so that we have time before we hop on radio and get to speak with all of you. To go to our favorite little doggy park and run around. And it's just a wonderful morning. And I have my maple pecan coffee. It's just so good. Someone else had a very good day, which is Donald Trump. He had a great day in court yesterday. A federal judge Tuesday, this coming from CNBC, indefinitely postponed the criminal classified documents trial of former President Trump. The trial on charges that Trump willfully retained classified national security records after leaving the White House and then hid them from federal authorities was scheduled to start May 20th. But the new ruling from U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon vacates that date and sets a new slate of pretrial proceedings, the latest of which is a hearing set for July 22nd. So the rule casts more doubt on whether Trump, the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, will face trial on federal criminal charges, at least in this case, prior to the November 5th election. But meanwhile, in New York City, where he is facing criminal charges, this trial is now in week, I think, like four. And it is proving, according also to CNBC, shockingly, to be a political hit job on Trump. The National Review says, as the former porn star Stormy Daniels' testimony unfolds, what has always been obvious becomes even more explicit. The point of this trial is to bruise Donald Trump politically, to humiliate him with a tawdry sexual episode from nearly 20 years ago that is utterly unnecessary to prove the charges in the indictment, even as those charges have been distorted by District Attorney Alvin Bragg and the Manhattan's elected progressive Democrat District Attorney, and to brand Trump a quote-unquote convicted felon so that his Democratic opponent, President Biden, can refer to him that way in the run-up to the 2020 election. And even people on CNN, commentators, are suggesting that this trial is not going so well. So this is a former federal judge on Stormy Daniels' testimony yesterday. This is cut two.
The material that came in was not relevant to this criminal case at all. And I think it shows that she was trying to get Trump. I actually thought there was a motive there. She said she hates him. She said she'd like to see him in prison. I think she was purposely throwing out this stuff to make sure the jurors were prejudiced, particularly the women jurors, but probably half of the men, too, were really put off.
Let's bring in our friend Josh Hammer, who is the senior editor at large for Newsweek and the host of the excellent The Josh Hammer Show. So, Josh, let's start in New York. I agree with this former federal judge, and it's shocking that she's giving this commentary on CNN. But this is such a ridiculous contrast between the absolute irrelevance of Stormy Daniels' testimony, and yet the judge allowed that but excluded expert testimony on campaign finance law, and yet I thought this case was entirely about campaign finance. So what's going on?
Jenna, it's difficult to know exactly what prosecutors are thinking when it comes to the New York case, because it really is just that utterly shambolic. I mean, this is a case, and I always like to mention this because I think it really says all you need to know about it. The underlying actual crime that Alvin Bragg needs to prove is a campaign finance violation, which notably is not actually a New York state crime, even though that he is simply a New York County, New York DA. He's not a federal prosecutor, but it's a federal crime. Now, the actual federal prosecutor's office there, the SDNY, the Southern District of New York, had investigated a lot of resources to look into prosecuting Donald Trump on this exact claim. They ultimately decided that it was not worth it, that it was simply not worth their time and energy, that it was too much of a stretch, legally speaking, and they ultimately exercised their prosecutorial discretion to not press charges. Not only that, but Alvin Bragg's own predecessor there in the New York County, New York DA's office, Cy Vance Jr., also looked into it and passed. So you had two other prosecutors who passed on this. The only reason that Alvin Bragg did not pass on this is because he is a Soros-funded hack with no sense of self-awareness or no compunction in any way whatsoever there. So I say all that to basically just illustrate the point that I don't think what's going on in Juan Merchan's courtroom right now has much, if anything, to do with the law, let alone the rule of law, more generally speaking. I think what's really going on here is that you have someone like Alvin Bragg, who is a cynical, career-driven prosecutor who is trying to advance his career in a liberal state, such as New York State, and he sees the clearest path forward to doing that is to drag the former president of the United States, the nefarious orange man, Donald Trump himself, drag him into court. And in so doing, what he's really doing, I think if you look between the lines here, it's only partially about the actual New York State fraudulent bookkeeping charge and furtherance of a campaign finance violation. What's really going on here, and the reason that you're trotting out people like Michael Cohen and Stormy Daniels and this whole Hollywood-esque band of characters from the 2016 campaign 8 years ago now, the reason that you're trotting all these people out is because Democrats are still getting over their post-traumatic stress disorder from the 2016 election. These are the same people who, to this day, facts to the contrary notwithstanding, still peddle the false claim, the false narrative that Russia somehow stole this election for Donald Trump. And I think that they're trying to maybe expiate some of their sins from what happened 8 years ago, 8 years later. They're trying to kind of get over the fact that they somehow did not prevent Donald Trump from defeating Hillary Clinton in that election. So I think there's a lot of psychology, if I'm kind of putting on my armchair psychologist hat, I think there's a lot of psychology kind of going on here, but very, very little of it is actually about the law, because on the law itself, this case in New York City is completely farcical.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, and I agree with the National Review's perspective on it, just saying that this is entirely to brand Trump a quote-unquote convicted felon, and we can almost guarantee that Biden, if he agrees to debates or not, that's going to be the way that he refers to Donald Trump, and this is what this case is all about. And it did get to trial, and so, I mean, we're in the midst. This is about week four. But let's turn Josh Hammer, my guest today, to the Florida case, because Democrats absolutely cannot stand U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon, because she's actually not out to get Trump. She's making reasonable, rational decisions based on the law and the matters before her. And so now this case, the classified documents case, which in my view is completely a hypocritical prosecution of Trump, where they're not going after Biden for basically the same thing. She's now indefinitely postponed this. So where does that leave Jack Smith and the DOJ in their pursuit of Trump, since this one, likely in Florida, will not see the inside of a courtroom, at least before the election?
So great news in this case, certainly for Donald Trump and his legal team. It was fairly expected, I should say, Jenna. So for a while, Judge Cannon has had May 20th as the start date on the docket for this case. But no one in their right mind, and I mean no one, actually thought that that was going to happen. In fact, even Jack Smith and his band of anti-Trump prosecutors, even they knew that the May 20th start date was not going to happen. In fact, in a court filing maybe about 3 to 4 weeks ago or so, Jack Smith actually made a formal motion before the judge there, Aileen Cannon, trying to push this from May 20th until after the July 4th recess, so around July 6th, 7th, 8th, somewhere around there or so. And again, that's the prosecutor. The Trump legal defense, on the other hand, basically responded to that motion to push it to July and basically said, okay, we really should push this until after the election, at a bare minimum, maybe August or September. When you start getting that late on the calendar, and when you're talking about a federal prosecution, recall also, Jenna, there is longstanding Department of Justice policy. It's right there, publicly available for all to read. It is clear and unambiguous Department of Justice policy that prosecutions shall not be tinged with politics. I mean, they state that. It nonetheless happens to be the case that they are prosecuting a current presidential candidate. But when the calendars start to turn to August, September, it really does become fairly unavoidable that the DOJ is doing exactly that, that they are meddling in the politics when they start prosecuting a current presidential candidate along these lines there. And then one other factor going on in the Florida case, Trump is actually using a lot of the same attorneys. So Todd Blanch among them, he's using a lot of the same legal counsel in both the New York and the Florida case. And there's a very simple reality that human beings are physically incapable of being in two places at once, too. So that's another factor going on there in the Florida case. So I do think at this point that it is extremely unlikely that the Florida case even commences really in earnest, let alone actually gets to a jury prior to the November election at this point. Certainly, I would share that conclusion as well when it comes to Jack Smith's case in Washington, D.C., given the fact that the Supreme Court just heard the immunity question. The immunity question actually is not the underlying substantive question. It's just an intermediate interlocutory appeal. So that's probably ultimately going to get kicked down to the district court judge, Tanya Chutkan, yet again there. It'll go up and down the federal courts again. So I think Trump overall is looking like a very lucky man, Jenna, when it comes to all these prosecutions right now. It really is only this New York case right now that is more likely than not to result in a verdict there. And I think that the odds of him getting acquitted in the New York case are, I wouldn't say they're high, but they're not low. I think it's basically somewhat of a coin flip. I mean, all you need is one. All you need is one juror right now. This case in New York is such a stretch, legally speaking. I take some solace in the fact that there are actually multiple lawyers in the jury pool. There are two lawyers. Two of the 12 jurors are lawyers. One's a corporate lawyer. One's a civil litigator. Now, are they probably liberal lawyers, given it's New York State? Maybe. But given the fact that it's such a stretch legally, as you and I have tried to explain to our audiences, I do take some solace in the fact that maybe the lawyers might start asking some very difficult questions and might reach an acquittal result there as well.
Yeah, I'm speaking with Josh Hammer, my guest this morning. He's the senior editor at large for Newsweek and host of The Josh Hammer Show. And, you know, from a kind of 30,000 foot perspective, you know, you mentioned earlier that the DOJ and their rules that are very open and known to the public, that they shouldn't have any sort of tinge of political bias in prosecutions and so forth. And yet we've seen the erosion of the rule of law and the whole notion that justice is blind. I mean, all of these things that, you know, you and I going through law school and really having a profound respect for the rule of law, for the process, you know, as attorneys ourselves and going through all this, I think that, you know, I respect the system and the process less over the last few years because of all of this. And if just because it's so clearly politically motivated. So what does this actually do for the rule of law from kind of a 30,000 foot perspective when we're seeing how the weaponization of the process is happening, even to someone like a former president?
Jenna, it's highly dispiriting. It's really, really, really depressing, honestly. I mean, I clerked for a federal judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. We had appellate jurisdiction over Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. I took my job very seriously when I was a law clerk. I continue to be friendly with many judges to this day. And many are very good people. Many prosecutors are very good people. But it's difficult to look at what is happening out there and conclude that this is all strictly by the book and that this is all strictly kosher. I mean, as you mentioned there, the classified documents case alone you know, Joe Biden, Mike Pence, for goodness sake, many of these other high profile figures have had their own very, very similar scandals. And it's very, very difficult to look at this, especially the way that Joe Biden special counsel situation was handled by Robert Hur and his own special counsel investigation. How can you conclude that the system does not stink? It seems to me like it really does stink quite a bit.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. And in just the last couple of minutes we have with you, Josh Hammer, and I always appreciate your legal analysis. We were talking yesterday about, you know, turning to Congress and the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act and how, you know, you and I disagree a little bit on maybe, you know, some of the language of that and what the implications are. But beyond that as well, we do agree that Congress, in their quest to, quote unquote, do something, should be looking at defunding these universities. And, you know, where is Congress in all of this? And where do you see this going with college administrations that receive, you know, over $1 billion in federal funding like Columbia, and yet their administration is clearly not following the rule of law either, or even just the rules of campus?
Look, Jenna, there are very few things that I think are more both policy and political winners than defunding American higher education in general, but at a bare minimum, a very, very low-hanging fruit place to start ought to be defunding all foreign investments and funding of American higher education. What's going on right now is the result of a lot of factors. You have the toxic brew of the post-1960s cultural Marxism and the Frankfurt School, the critical theory ideology. All of those chickens are coming home to roost. You have a lot of immigration and affirmative action chickens that are coming home to roost as well. But you can't ignore the fact that many of these faculties and personnel have been highly radicalized by foreign funders. So the Qatari government, to give one example, has invested billions and billions of dollars, the most of any country in the world. This is a tiny, tiny Islamist country that supports Hamas. They run their Al Jazeera network. They fan the flames of radical Islam all throughout the Middle East and throughout the world. Qatar is the number one funder of American higher education, more than China, the UK, France, you name it. And many leading universities such as Cornell and Northwestern even have campuses there in Doha, Qatar. It is an absolute travesty, and there is no reason whatsoever, constitutionally speaking, that Congress cannot simply legislate using its Article 1, Section 8 foreign commerce power to simply say that this is not okay and we are not going to stand for this. Congress could shut that down tomorrow if they wanted to, and they should absolutely do so, I think.
I completely agree, and I think that even with the slim majority that Speaker Johnson is wielding in the House, this should be something that is bipartisan. But we know that, you know, the Democrats are cultural Marxists, and they're actually for this and for the view of being, you know, pro-terrorism, pro-Hamas. And so, you know, whether or not they can actually do this, that should be Speaker Johnson's immediate attention and his immediate prerogative, rather than, you know, going for, you know, some of these other more optics driven narratives. But Josh Hammer, really appreciate your insight as always. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. You've heard a lot about saving babies on this show, and that's because it's important to me personally. And let me just be frank with you, we need to save them. That's why we've partnered with Preborn, the nation's leader in introducing mothers with unplanned pregnancies to their babies. And once she hears that heartbeat and sees that precious life growing inside of her, she is twice as likely to choose life. Now that's a miracle. But quite honestly, if we don't save them, who will? Preborn receives no government funding, so their work is completely dependent on us. Preborn has rescued over 280,000 babies. And that's not all. They provide love, support, and counseling for up to 2 years for free, saving lives and souls. One ultrasound is just $28, or $140, helps to rescue 5 babies' lives. Abortion doesn't stop, so we can't. Together, you and I can save lives. Just dial #250 on your cell and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And as we continue to see what is unfolding on campuses across the country with these pro-Hamas, pro-terror protests, and now some universities like Columbia are canceling their in-person university-wide commencements, we're also looking at how the U.S. is handling its foreign policy, what's going on in Israel. And the headline from allisrael.com this morning is delegations from the U.S., Qatar, Israel, and Hamas resume indirect negotiations for hostage deal in Cairo. This coming as there are still some talks of a ceasefire. And joining me now is Joel Rosenberg, who's the editor-in-chief of All Israel News. You can find that at allisrael.com. And Joel, it's been a minute since we've had you, and I really always appreciate your insight. And, you know, so where do you want to begin? What is the latest in terms of what's going on there in Jerusalem?
Well, it's great to be with you, Jana. And, you know, every time I talk to you, I think I used to be, you know, I'm a fiction writer by trade, right? I write political thrillers, sold 5 million copies of those. But I cannot make up what the Biden administration's doing. It's worse than fiction. So on the one hand, President Biden claims to be pro-Israel, but the latest several days have been absolutely bizarre. Really quickly. So Israel offers its most generous offer to get all our hostages back through the United States mediators, right, through Qatar, through Egypt, so it gets transmitted to the Hamas leadership. Secretary of State Blinken at the World Economic Forum a couple of days ago says that the Israeli offer is extraordinarily, extraordinarily generous. He actually used the word extraordinarily twice. That's pretty high praise from a Secretary of State who has not said many positive things about Israel of late. But what happens? Over the weekend, Hamas announces that it's going to accept the deal. And this becomes a huge story. And it raises the hopes of the hostage families. And then what we find out is actually Hamas is accepting their own draft of the deal that Israel has never seen. Now, with a little bit more time that passes, we learn that CIA Director Bill Burns, who's doing sort of shuttle diplomacy in the region, that Burns has actually seen the Hamas draft, but didn't show it to Israel. So Hamas gets the credit in all the international media that they've accepted a deal. They cruelly raise the expectations of terror families who are waiting to get their loved ones back after more than 215 days of horror. But it's all not true. Hamas hasn't accepted anything. What they want, the essential element of the Hamas offer, as it were, to Israel is, we might give you some back, but only if you declare that you're going to surrender and leave Gaza forever and put us back in charge. So obviously that's never going to happen. But the fact that the Biden administration is treating Hamas like an equal, like it's a sovereign state, and actually biasing in favor of their proposals and keeping its own sovereign ally in the dark, I couldn't make this up if I was writing a novel about a horrible American president. I'm not grateful for all the good things that Biden has done for Israel, but now Biden is suspending arms shipments to us in the middle of a hot war with a terrorist entity. So I'll stop there, but it's scratching the surface of how bad this is.
Yeah, and the Babylon Bee, you know, the great satire site, which I think is valid satire, notwithstanding those who don't, their headline, you know, and this is just ridiculous because, like you said, you know, if you tried to write this in fiction or even satire, it's hilarious. Their headline was, breaking, Hamas offers to release zero hostages in exchange for all Jews being wiped from the face of the earth. And that kind of sums up, you know, that's satire, but it's getting really, really close to the truth. And this coming, of course, as Biden is now, and the administration is considering bringing in refugees from Gaza when we still have American hostages. I mean, this is bizarre, the priorities for the Biden administration.
Yeah. And so here's the thing. Now I'm going to add to all that. You'd think I was writing fiction, what I just said, but it's all true. Now let's add the second chapter. The second chapter is he's declared a red line for Israel regarding to whether Israel should send its military forces into Rafah, which is the southernmost city in the Gaza Strip, right along the Egyptian border. And that's where all the senior Hamas terror leaders are living underground in their bunkers, and where four remaining divisions of Hamas terrorists are holed up underneath that city of Rafah. Now, Biden has been saying for 3 months, you may not go in. Do not go in. We want a permanent ceasefire. We don't want you to go in. Why is the president of the United States putting so much pressure on his Democratic ally to not finish off a genocidal terror organization? Why is the Biden administration saying we won't send you any more bombs and bullets right now because you're starting to go into Rafah and we told you not to? To the Israeli government's credit, and they have made missteps in this war, but to Israel's government's credit, it waited for 3 months trying to understand why would the Biden administration not want us to finish the job as soon as possible? Yes, while doing everything we can to protect civilian lives, but still, you still have to defeat Hamas. Why is Biden putting so much pressure on him not to do it? So basically, when Biden and Bill Burns pulled this fast one of not showing Israel the draft that Hamas was going to accept and get all those media credit for, you didn't hear the Israeli government screaming and pounding the table and going crazy. We just started sending tanks into Rafah. And there is, and at this point, we've mobilized forces, we've sent in tanks. And I think, yes, you could say it's a negotiating tactic, meaning force Hamas to realize if they don't give up these hostages, they're all going to die or be arrested. But I don't think it's a tactic. I don't think it's a negotiating tactic. I think the Israeli government and the Israeli people have had it. We appreciate President Biden and the American people's support, but we're not going to have our hands cuffed to not finish off Hamas. We waited for 3 months. The terrorists have not released the hostages. Biden hasn't changed his tune, and we're going in.
Well, and Israel has the sovereign right to do it.
Under a Harvard poll that just came out last week, I think it's 73 or 75% of Americans support Israel going into Rafah to finish off Hamas, even in defiance of Biden. And I think that tells you a lot. I don't think 75% of Americans are paying super close attention. They're paying attention, but they're not, that they would even know what Rafah is. But it shows that the American people's instincts are right on this. 80% are standing with Israel against Hamas. 75% are saying go into Rafah and finish the job. 65-ish percent are saying don't accept a ceasefire unless you get all the hostages back and Hamas will never be in charge again. So those are all positive signs. They don't reflect the views of, crazies on the campus of Columbia University or Harvard or elsewhere. And I'll just say this, I caught the last part of your interview with Josh Hammer. Look, most people, I think, even on those campuses are against what's happening. Why are commencement ceremony for people who work very, very hard to get their degree being canceled rather than flooding the zone with police and shutting down this nonsense? The tail is wagging the dog here.
Yeah, and I'm speaking with Jill Rosenberg, who's the editor-in-chief of All Israel News, and you can find the latest headlines from Jerusalem at allisrael.com. And so all of this is now also, Jill, with the backdrop of the reports that the International Criminal Court is potentially going to indict and arrest Benjamin Netanyahu, prime minister, and then also potentially other Israeli leaders. And the Biden administration, through the Secretary of State, have basically said, and they've said openly, that the ICC doesn't have the jurisdiction to do that. So indirectly, the U.S. isn't supporting that. But how is that factoring into, if at all, Israel's strategy here? I mean, do you think that the Israeli leaders even care about that potential threat?
Well, leaders do care about this because it means that no Israeli leader would be able to get on a plane and go, come to the United States or go to visit Europe or Africa or Asia or wherever else, either on diplomatic mission or on business or just on personal travel without fear of being arrested and under some crazy, world court that has no jurisdiction. This is why Prime Minister Netanyahu and the Israeli government has to walk a fine line, right? We disagree with President Biden about going into Rafah. We think that's absolutely essential. But on the other hand, we are, we're a small country, and the United States is the world's only superpower. We're, the size of New Jersey, and you guys are, a continental nation. We can't afford to just completely, thumb our noses or put a stiff, say, talk to the hand when it comes to the United States. So our leaders are listening. They don't always agree with Biden and Blinken and Burns, but they are listening. And I think after 3 months in a hot war, when you keep hearing nonsense, you say, thank you very much. I appreciate your input. We are now acting in our self-defense, but you have to do it respectfully because we do need American arms. This is a situation which I was just praising Biden last week and Congress, led by Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson. I was doing it on your show, among other places, to say, thank God that this $26 billion emergency aid package for Israel finally got passed. It's a profile in courage of Mike Johnson to do it, even in the face of people saying, we're going to chuck you out of office if you do it. So he did it, and he showed great courage, and Biden signed it, and he gets credit for that. But now of the very aid, military aid that Biden has approved and that Congress has approved, is now being stopped by Biden. Why? Because Biden is looking for ways to show leverage against Israel to not go into Rafah. It's very, very challenging, but we need this relationship. We want this relationship to work between Israel and the United States. We don't want it to be a train wreck. But as I've been reporting at All Israel News and on my weekly primetime show on TBN, the Rosenberg Report, this is getting more and more difficult to work with Biden and Chuck Schumer and senior Democrats, because even the Democrats that say they're pro-Israel keep taking actions that are not pro-Israel. They're not even pro-ally, right? And other allies are watching, right? The Taiwanese are watching. The South Koreans are watching. The Japanese are watching. The Ukrainians are watching. NATO is watching. How does Biden treat an ally? Not that good.
Yeah, it's so unfortunate that it's right, yeah, that it's so political and politically driven. And yet, here in America, we are in a presidential election year. And it's surprising to me, Joel Rosenberg, that Donald Trump isn't taking the opportunity to shine the light. I mean, he has tried to draw this, and his campaign has tried to draw this contrast between, the Biden economy and the good years under Trump and all of these other distinctions that, that we all, I think, common sense would agree with, regardless of politics. But he's focusing more domestically rather than taking the opportunity to say, remember when I was president and we had a great relationship with Israel and I actually brought the embassy, to Jerusalem and the Abrahamic Accords and all of these, remember those things and how Putin wasn't invading Ukraine and all of these other things. Why do you think, just from a political perspective, if Joe Biden is making all of these very bad decisions in terms of the United States foreign policy, it seems like that's a good opportunity for the Trump campaign?
That's true. And I can give you a more concise answer than my other answers. And it would be two words: Stormy Daniels. Right now, the president is engulfed in a legal fight that becomes a tabloid media frenzy that wouldn't allow him to get another message out if he tried right now. And this is the Democratic strategy, right?
Of course.
Why did people vote for Biden 4 years ago? Because they thought, he's boring and he'll bring the temperature down and things will be quiet again. And things in Trump world are just too, they're a little too crazy for us. Well, now Biden is presiding over a country where the lunatics are running the asylums of Columbia University and Harvard and Princeton. And and USC and whatever, and you know, inflation and all the rest, and that would look horrible, except the Biden Democratic strategy is to create so much chaos around President Trump that he is hindered from saying, you know, as president, don't you remember? I mean, because a couple months ago, I was at the National Religious Broadcasters Convention, 4,000-plus evangelical communicators, and Trump gave the keynote, gave a 90-minute speech, very warmly received. And this is not a MAGA crowd, right? National Religious Broadcasters has some MAGA people in it, but it's not, you know, some rally in West Virginia. This is, you know, a much more, you know, educated and sophisticated, if you want to say it that way, evangelical audience that might have listened potentially to Nikki Haley, probably was a little bit more DeSantis than Trump, but he wowed that audience. I was sitting there, and he did that by giving the exact speech you just said. But now, in a courtroom, he can't say anything at the moment. And the question is how much to throw him off his game going forward.
Yeah, and hopefully it doesn't. But Joel Rosenberg, always so appreciate it when you can drop by, hopefully weekly as we continue, and we continue to pray for you. Go to allisrael.com. And I loved your description of Trump World as, wah! I can attest, having been there, that's pretty apt. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And a couple of last cases from the Supreme Court and other filings that you should be aware of. First, this coming from NBC, TikTok is suing the United States government in an effort to stop enforcement of a bill passed last month that seeks to force the app's Chinese owner to sell the app or have it banned. The lawsuit that was filed yesterday in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit argues that the bill, the Protecting Americans from Foreign Adversary Controlled Applications Act, violates constitutional protections of free speech. The suit calls the law a, quote, unprecedented violation of the First Amendment. Funny that the Chinese Communist Party is arguing for free speech, but we're at that place in our nation's history. And the company argues that invoking national security concerns is not a sufficient reason for restricting free speech, and the burden is on the federal government to prove that this restriction is warranted. It has not met that burden, the lawsuit states. And so the law from Congress gave ByteDance, which is the parent company of TikTok, 270 days to sell TikTok to a new company that will be allowed to operate it in the U.S., or else the app will be banned from American networks and online application stores, according to The Hill. And this, and also the president, Joe Biden, currently can give ByteDance an additional 90 days to sell TikTok if he determines that it's necessary. Another headline from The Hill is that the Supreme Court just quietly handed a huge win to veterans. So the Supreme Court recently decided on a case you might not have heard about. It's underreported landmark ruling about the GI Bill could have a massive positive effect on America's veterans, our communities, and our nation for years to come. So the writer of that piece in The Hill, Tommy Marquez, who is a board member of the Pipitter Foundation, a veteran of the U.S. Navy, and we so appreciate your service, sir, and a former senior staffer in the U.S. House of Representatives, joins me now. So, Tommy, this is a great win.
Yeah, it's an extremely great win. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So this was a 7-2 ruling, and describe what the court ultimately held in this case.
Ultimately, the court ruled in favor of Army veteran James Redisil. And essentially, they said that there is no good reason that the VA was forcing veterans to either decide between their Montgomery GI Bill or their post-9/11 benefits for a total combined 36 months. What they should do is create a 48-month limit. So if you meet the criteria for both your Montgomery GI Bill, which means you served pretty much any time before 2008, and you have 3 years of honorable service, and any time past 2001, and you have 3 years of credible service deemed honorable, you can get the GI Bill. And so there is a code and federal regulation that requires it to be limited to 48 months, but this means that veterans could potentially be getting, who meet that criteria, who are about 1.7 million is estimated, they can get 12 additional months of GI Bill benefits. And I know that sounds like only a year, but for those of us who use the GI Bill, I want to explain this. You could essentially, if you play your cards right, get 2 years of education for free and get a housing allowance for about 2 years of education time with that 12 months.
So it's a huge
win for veterans.
Yeah, and so what was the argument at the Supreme Court? I mean, you know, this seems like this would be a very straightforward issue for veterans, but you know, obviously this was a controversy that came up to the Supreme Court.
Well, based on my experience in Congress, one thing I learned is that they write laws that are vague in nature. So there was never anything in the law that was written that specifically said, hey, and they must give up their old Montgomery GI Bill. And so it's left to interpretation by bureaucrats. And I know everyone talks about term limits all the time with members of Congress. But let me tell you where term limits need to be. It's with bureaucrats, because you can't hire them, you can't fire them, and you have no control over them. And the bureaucrats in the VA are probably my least favorite of all the bureaucrats. They're pretty high on my list. As a veteran and as a former senior congressional staffer who helped thousands of veterans try to obtain their benefits. But like, honestly, it was just a constant fight for veterans to get the benefits that they already had earned. So administratively, the VA took that law and said, okay, well, you guys are going to have to give this up in order to get this. And the Supreme Court, and I couldn't believe the ruling, because they had some other rulings recently that were unanimous, that were against the veteran. But in this case, they went ahead and they sided with the veteran. And this is just such a huge opportunity. I can't explain just how big this is, because there's so many veterans who I know who reach out to me on my social media still. I don't do VA benefits anymore. I don't work in Congress. But because so many people still contact me, I started doing social media. And so, you know, just, hey, here's the rules. Here's how to go around this. Here's the actual facts. Go get yourself help. And I've been contacted by so many veterans who said, you know, I wish I had a little bit more GI Bill. I go to this trade school. I go to this technical school. I go to this college. And now this is going to probably be their opportunity to do that. So it's going to be life-changing, not only for those 1.7 million veterans potentially, but their entire family.
Wow. And, you know, what a great story. And also for you, you know, sharing your personal story as well, which you talk about in this piece in The Hill. And for people who want to read this full article, it is in The Hill. The title is "The Supreme Court Just Quietly Handed a Huge Win to Veterans." And, you know, and it's really unfortunate, Tommy, that that a lot of this attention to some of these wins to veterans and things that we should focus on aren't in the media as much, because it's not as controversial, or it's not as, you know, maybe important to the mainstream media as, you know, what's going on in New York right now in a Manhattan courtroom. But these are things that really affect a lot of Americans, and especially the veterans who proudly served our country and keep us free. And so, you know, for people who are listening who may be thinking, oh, this may apply to me, you know, where do they go for some of this help or to figure out what benefits they can actually get now under this Supreme Court ruling?
So, unfortunately, right now we're all in a limbo stage. I'm going to be honest with everyone. I just did a piece on this on my social media, telling everyone, hey, just hang out, because we're going to find out how the VA is going to implement this. You know, the Supreme Court gave a ruling, and again, their ruling was a little vague. They didn't give a timeline of when this needs to be done. So, I'm a man of action, and Pi Peter Foundation is a great organization, and they've allowed me to go out there, and I am actually next week meeting with several members of Congress, and we are specifically talking about this ruling. And what I am trying to encourage, and Pi Peter Foundation is encouraging this as well, we're trying to encourage the members of Congress to write a letter to the VA about a timeline. They want a timeline, that they want parameters, and whenever possible to give the most beneficial benefit to the veteran. And so we hope to be providing you guys updates. I'll definitely give a follow-up here if you allow me to. I'll be putting it on my social media and at Pi Peter Foundation. The last place it'll probably get put out on is the VA's website, the va.gov. You know, I just did a TikTok Live, I'll just be honest, with the former Undersecretary of VA Benefits, Dr. Paul Wartz. We were talking about the problems at the VA. And one of the biggest problems is they're never the tip of the spear. They're going to be the last people to kind of tell you what their administrative rulings are going to be. So we're going to monitor it. We're going to try and encourage it and set parameters by using Congress, lobbying Congress. And that's what I do. I lobby Congress now to try to get benefits for veterans. And hopefully with the Pipefitter Foundation support, we could do that. And we'll be providing that information as it comes out.
Great. And yeah, and definitely follow up with us when you have more information. We'd love to do a follow up. And you can, on at least on X on social media, you can go to Pipefitter Foundation.
Yep.
It's at Pipefitter FDN. And then your handle there is at TJ Marquez 23. Is that true across social media? Is that your handle or just on X?
No, on my handle on the other social medias is at Tommy Marquez Consulting.
Okay.
I just put all the information out there so that people can find the real truth about VA benefits and discounts and deals. But if I could just say one last thing, if you allow me just two quick seconds here. If you're a veteran and you're one of those 1.7 million and you've been waiting for a sign from God to help you get your life on track, like I was waiting in the very beginning, I was scared to go to college. And keep in mind, you don't have to go to college. You can go to a technical school. You can go to a trade school. You can do a million different things. This is your time. This is your time to get your life together and get out there, use these benefits and improve your quality of life, not just for you, but your entire family. The GI Bill took me from being in my car with my three kids and having $7 to eat as a veteran with no job to a whole different stratosphere of life and potential earnings and ability to make money. And that came from 2 years of education. So I'm not telling you this to brag. I'm telling you this because this is your chance. Please go out there, use these benefits. And if you're not one of the 1.7 million that are affected by this, I highly encourage you to check out social media because there's a million different other benefits like Chapter 35, Chapter 32, VR&E. There's a million different benefits besides the GI Bill, which you could get more benefits for education, training, or technical schools. So please, please, please don't succumb to the 22-a-day madness. You know, fight for your benefits, go out there, get the information, and improve your life.
So well said. And Tommy, I really appreciate it. Thank you for your service to this country.
Thank you.
And I also agree.
It was my honor.
Well, thank you. And I also agree that, you know, the bureaucrats in Washington and that part of the deep state swamp are really what we do need to have term limits on. And I know that it's a controversial topic, even among conservatives, the Article 5 Convention of States. But one of the main reasons among many that I am an advocate for the Convention of States project as an attorney, as someone who loves the Constitution, and as someone who has studied this extensively for, you know, over a decade, just the Article 5 process specifically, this is one of the items in the petition from the Convention of States project is that term limits can be an item for debate for a constitutional amendment that would not just apply to elected officials, but like Tommy was saying, like a lot of other people have said on this program and elsewhere, that it's really the deep state bureaucrats that control everything. And then, you know, the office holders come and go, but the people who are at the heart of the swamp, the only real way to drain the swamp and get rid of them is to flush them out through term limits. And that is a hugely important part of that petition. I've had Mark Meckler, who's the founder of the Convention of States Project, on this program before. You can go to AFR.net, look under the icon for Jenna Ellis in the Morning. You can see all of the prior programs as well. And then just one last thing as we're wrapping up here, you know, Tommy said, this is your day and this is your moment. And so I just want to remind you of Ephesians 2:10 that says, for we are God's handiwork, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which God prepared in advance for us to do. So if you are in this moment at a life transition stage and you're not really sure where to go next, I've been there in life many times, even in my 39 years, we can pray and trust the Lord that we are called to do good works, which God prepared in advance for us to do. If you are living and breathing today, God has ministry for you. He has a calling for you. He has work for you to do for His glory. So make it a great day. You can always reach me and my team, Jenna at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.